The workmaster shrugged his whipcord shoulders, and his moist eyes suddenly filled with expression. The other prisoners didn't try to kill him. He didn't get himself in trouble. And we worked some of the fat and weakness out of him.
"Is this part of my training?" Duncan asked.
"A labor crew to toughen me up?" The bald woman placed her hands on her narrow hips. "This was a genuine prison crew, Idaho. These men are murderers and thieves, assigned here for the rest of their lives."
"And you sent me here? With them?"
Jamo Reed came forward and gave him a surprising hug. "Yes, Rat, and you survived. As did he, Resser." He gave Duncan a paternal pounding on the back. "I'm proud of you." Embarrassed and confused, Duncan mustered a disbelieving snort. "I lived through worse prisons when I was an 8-year-old boy."
"And you will face worse from this day forward."
In a no-nonsense tone, Karsty Topper explained. "This was a test of character and obedience. And patience. A swordmaster must have the patience to study an opponent, to implement a plan, to ambush the enemy.
But a real swordmaster usually has more information about his situation," Duncan said.
"Now we have seen what you can do with yourself, Rat." Reed wiped a tear from his own cheek. "Don't let me down. I expect to see you on your final day of testing."
8 years from now," Duncan said.
Topper directed him toward the still fluttering Thopter. He was delighted to see that she had brought the old Duke sword back to him. The bald woman had to raise her voice to be heard over the loud hum of the aircraft's engines as she applied thrust.
"Now it is time to begin your real training."
Special knowledge can be a terrible disadvantage if it leads you too far along a path that you cannot explain anymore. Mentat admonition. In a meditation alcove in the darkest basement of Harkonnen Keep, Peter DeVries could not hear the screech of amputation saws or the screams of torture victims from an open doorway just down the hall. His mentat concentration was focused too intensely on other, more important matters. Numerous harsh drugs enhanced his thinking process. Sitting with his eyes closed, he pondered the clockwork of the Imperium, how the cogs meshed and slipped and ground together. The great and minor houses of the Landsrad, the Spacing Guild, the Bene Gesserit, and the commercial trading conglomerate Choam were the key cogs, and all depended upon one thing: melange. The spice. House Harkonnen reaped huge profits from its spice monopoly. When they learned of the secret Project Amal years ago, the Baron had needed little coaxing to realize how he would suffer financial ruin if a cheap melange substitute were ever developed, one that made Arrakis worthless. The Emperor, or more likely Fenring, had hidden the artificial spice scheme well. He'd buried the vastly expensive project in the vagaries of the imperial budget, imposed higher taxes here, trumped up fines there, called in long-standing debts, sold valuable properties. But Peter DeVries knew where to look. Consequences, plans, preparations, third and fourth-order ripples that could not remain invisible. Only a mentat could follow them all. And the indications pointed to a long-term project that would bring about the economic ruin of House Harkonnen. The Baron, however, would not go quietly. He had even attempted to start a war between the Bene Tlelax and House Atreides in order to destroy the Amal work. But that plan had failed, thanks to the damnable Duke Leto. Since then, infiltrating spies onto the planet formerly known as Ix had proved predictably difficult, and his mentat projections gave him no reason to believe that Tlelaxu had ceased their experiments. Indeed, since the Emperor was sending 2 more legions of Peacekeeper Sadukar to Ix, the research might finally be reaching a head.
or Shaddam might be reaching the limits of his patience. Now, in his Mentat trance, De Vries did not move a muscle, other than his eyes. A tray of mind-enhancing drugs hung around his neck, a slowly spinning platform like a table centerpiece. A yellow carrion fly landed on his nose, but he didn't see it, didn't feel it. The insect crawled onto his lower lip and kissed the spilled, bitter sappho juice there. De Vries studied the rotating smorgasbord of drugs, and with a flick of his eyes stopped the turntable. The tray tilted, pouring a vial of Tikopia syrup into his mouth, and with it the hapless fly, followed by a capsule of melange concentrate. The Mentat bit down on the spice capsule and swallowed, tasting an explosion of sweet-burning cassia essence. Then he summoned a second capsule, more melange than he had ever consumed in one sitting. But he needed the clarity now. A torture victim in a distant cell howled, babbling a confession. But De Vries noticed nothing. Impervious to distractions, he plunged deeper into his own mind. Deeper. He felt his awareness opening, an unfolding of time like the spreading petals of a flower. He flowed along a continuum, each part accessible to his brain. He saw his exact place in it. In his mind's eye, one of several possible futures became clear, an extraordinary Mentat projection based upon an avalanche of information and intuition, enhanced by massive melange consumption. The vision was a series of painful film book images, visual spikes driven into his eyes. He saw the Tleilaxu master researcher proudly holding a vial of synthetic spice and laughing as he consumed it for himself. Success! A blur. He saw the Harkonnens on Arrakis packing up, leaving all their spice production behind. Troops of armed Sardaukar guards marched blurred figures to an imperial transport, taking them away from holdings on the desert world. He saw the Harkonnen Blue Griffin banner taken down from the fortress in Carthag and the residency at Arrakeen, and replaced with the green and black of House Atreides. A strangled noise came from his throat, and his Mentat mind sifted through the prescient images, forced them into a pattern, and tried to translate what he had seen. The Harkonnens will lose their spice monopoly, but not necessarily because of the Amal being developed by the Tleilaxu in collusion with the Emperor. How then? As the drug's multi-tentacled hold tightened, smothering him, his mind streaked down one avenue of synapses after another. Each time he found nothing, only dead ends. He circled around and tried again, but reached the same conclusion. How will it happen? Heavy consumption of mixed drugs was not an approved method of stimulating mind powers. But he wasn't a normal Mentat, a gifted person accepted into the school and trained in the arcane methods of data sorting and analysis. Peter De Vries was a twisted Mentat, grown in a Tleilaxu axolotl tank from the cells of a dead Mentat and trained by others who had broken from the Mentat school. After dispensing their warped training, the Tleilaxu retained no control over their Mentats, though De Vries had no doubt that they had another fully grown Gola, genetically identical to him, just waiting, in case Baron Harkonnen happened to lose patience with him one too many times. The Tleilaxu twisting produced an enrichment that could be obtained in no other way. It gave De Vries greater capabilities, far beyond what normal Mentats could attain. But it also made him unpredictable and dangerous, potentially beyond control. For decades, the Bene Tleilax had experimented with drug combinations on their Mentats. In his formative years, De Vries had been one of their subjects. The effects had been unpredictable and inconclusive, resulting in alterations, improvements, he hoped, to his brain. Ever since he'd been sold to House Harkonnen, De Vries had performed his own tests, refining his body, tuning it to the condition he wanted. With just the right mixture of chemicals, he had achieved a high degree of mental clarity for faster processing of data. Why will House Harkonnen lose the spice monopoly? And when? It seemed wise to suggest to the Baron that he reinforce his operations, double-check the secret melange stockpiles hidden on Lankyvile and elsewhere. We must protect ourselves from this disaster. His heavy eyelids flickered, lifted. Bright particles of light swam into his eyes. With difficulty, he focused his vision. He heard squealing. Past the half-closed door, two uniformed men wheeled a squeaky gurney, on top of which lay a misshapen lump that had once been a human form. Why will House Harkonnen lose its spice monopoly? Sadly, he realized the drugs he had administered were wearing off, dissipated in the effort to unravel the troubled, prescient vision. Why? He needed to take this to an even deeper level. I must learn the answer. In a frenzy, he detached the drug tray from his neck, dumping juice and capsules on the floor. Falling to his knees, he gathered all the pills he could find and swallowed them. Like an animal, he lapped up spilled Sappho juice before he huddled in a jittering heap on the cold floor. Why? When a pleasurable feeling came over him, he lay back on the sticky, wet surface, staring at the ceiling. His involuntary body functions slowed, giving him the outward appearance of death. But his mind was racing, its electrochemical activity increasing, neurons sorting signals, processing, searching, electrical impulses leaping synaptic gaps faster and faster. Why? Why? His cognitive pathways fired in all directions, crossed, sizzled. Potassium and sodium ions collided with other radicals in his brain cells. The internal mechanisms broke down, no longer able to handle the fire hose flow of data. He was on the brink of vaulting into mental chaos and slipping into a coma. Instead, his marvelous Mentat mind went into survival mode, shutting down functions, limiting the damage. Peter de Vries awoke in a pool of spilled drug residue. His nostrils, mouth, and throat burned. At the Mentat's side, the Baron paced back and forth, scolding him like a child. "Look at the mess you've made, Peter. All that wasted melange, and I almost had to purchase a new Mentat from the Tleilaxu. Don't ever be so thoughtless and wasteful again." De Vries struggled to sit up, wanting to tell the Baron about his vision, the destruction of House Harkonnen. I have seen..." But he could not get the words out. It would take a long time before he was able to string sentences together coherently. Worse yet, even with his desperate overdose, he still did not have an answer for the Baron. Too much knowledge never makes for simple decisions. Crown Prince Raphael Corino, Discourses on Leadership. Within the ice-choked Arctic Circle of Lankyvile, commercial whale fur boats were like cities on the water, enormous processing plants that lumbered across the steel-gray waters for months before returning to spaceport docks to disgorge their cargo. Abelard Harkonnen, the Baron's younger half-brother, preferred smaller vessels with native crews. To them, whale hunting was a challenge and an art, rather than an industry. Biting wind blew his ash-blonde hair around his ears and shoulders as he squinted pale-eyed into the distance. The sky was a soup of dirty clouds, but he'd grown accustomed to the climate. Despite the glamorous and expensive Harkonnen palaces on other planetary holdings, Abelard had chosen this frigid, mountainous world to call home. He had been out on the sea for a week now, cheerfully attempting to assist the swarthy crew, though his appearance was far different from that of the Lankavile natives. His hands were sore and covered with blisters that sooner or later would turn to calluses. The Buddhist-Lamic whalers seemed bemused that their planetary governor wanted to come out and work. But they knew his eccentricities. Abelard had never been one for pomp and ceremony, for abusing his power, or showing off his riches. In the deep northern seas, Beyondak's fur whales swam in herds like aquatic bison. Golden-furred beasts were common. Those with exotic leopard spots were much rarer. Standing next to rattling prayer wheels and streamers, lookouts on observation platforms scanned the ice-thick sea with binoculars, searching for lone whales. Off-shift whalers took turns praying. These native hunters were selective of the beasts they killed, choosing only those with the best coats that would bring in the highest prices. Abelard smelled the salt air and the omnipresent tang of impending sleet. He waited for the action to begin. For a fast hunt, when the captain and his first mate would bellow orders, treating Abelard as just another crewman. For now, he had nothing to do but wait and think about home. At night, when the whaling boat rocked and swayed, accompanied by the patter and thump of ice chunks bumping against the reinforced hull, Abelard would sing or play a local betting game that involved stacked beads. He would recite required sutras with the gruff, deeply religious crew. Glowing heaters inside the boat cabins could not match the roaring fireplaces in his bustling main lodge on Tula Fjord or his romantic private dacha at the mouth of the fjord. Although he enjoyed the whale hunt, Abelard already missed his quiet and strong wife. He and Emmy Rabban Harkonnen had been married for decades, and the separation of days would only make their reunion sweeter. Emmy had noble blood, but from a diminished minor house. 4 generations ago, before the alliance with House Harkonnen, Lankavile had been the fief of an unimportant family, House Rabban, which had devoted itself to religious pursuits. They built monasteries and seminary retreats in the rugged mountains, instead of exploiting the resources of their world. Long ago, after the death of his father, Dimitri, Abelard had taken Emmy with him to spend 7 unpleasant years on Arrakis. His elder half-brother Vladimir had consolidated all the power of House Harkonnen in his iron fist, but their father's will had given control of spice operations to Abelard, the kind and bookish son. Abelard understood the importance of the position, how much wealth Melange brought to his family, though he never grasped the nuances and political complexities of the desert world. Abelard had been forced to leave Arrakis in supposed disgrace. But no matter what they said, he preferred to live on Lankavile with manageable responsibilities, among people he understood. He felt sorry for those being trampled by the Baron's overzealous efforts on the desert planet. But Abelard vowed to do his best here, though he had not yet bothered to reclaim his rightful title of sub-district governor. The tedious politics seemed like such a waste of human effort. He and Emmy had only one son, 34-year-old Glasu Rabban, who, according to Lankavile tradition, was given the distaff name from his mother's bloodline. Unfortunately, their son had a coarse personality and took after his uncle more than his own parents. Although Abelard and Emmy had always wanted more children, the Harkonnen bloodline had never been particularly fecund. "Albino!" shouted the lookout, a sharp-eyed boy whose dark hair hung in a thick braid kinked over his warm parka. "White fur swimming alone, 20 degrees to port." The vessel became a hive of activity. Neuro harpooners grabbed their weapons while the captain increased the engine speed. Men scrambled up deck ladders, shading their eyes and staring into water laden with icebergs that looked like buoyant white molars. It had been a full day since the last chase, so the decks were clean, the processing bins open and prepped, the men anxious.
Abelard waited his turn to peer through a set of binoculars, staring across the whitecaps. He saw flashes that might have been an albino whale, but were instead just chunks of drifting ice. Finally, he spotted the creature as it breached, a creamy arc of white fur. It was young. Albinos, the rarest of the breed, were ostracized from the pod, cut loose and left without the support of the swimming herd. Rarely did they survive to full adulthood. The men bent to their weapons as the vessel bore down upon its prey. Prayer wheels continued to spin and clack in the breeze. The captain leaned out from the bridge deck and shouted in a voice resonant enough to break solid ice, "If we get this one undamaged, we'll have enough shares to go home." Abelard loved to see the sheer joy and exhilaration on their faces. He felt the thrill himself, his heart pounding to keep the blood moving in this intense cold. He never took a share of the whaling profits, since he had no use for additional money, but allowed the men to divide it among themselves. The albino beast, sensing pursuit, swam faster, heading toward an archipelago of icebergs. The captain increased the throbbing engines, churning a wake behind them. If the Beyondax whale dove, they would lose it. Fur whales spent months at a time beneath the heavy ice sheets. There, in dark waters fed by volcanic vents, full of nutrients and warmth, the whales devoured swarms of krill, spores, and Lankaviles' rich plankton that did not require direct sunlight for photosynthesis. With a loud pop, one of the long-range rifles planted a pulse tag on the white whale's back. In response to the prick, the albino dove. The crewman working the controls sent a jolt of electricity through the pulse tag, which made the whale breach again. The boat came about, grinding the starboard side against an iceberg, but the reinforced hull held as the captain closed the gap. Two master harpooners, moving with forced calm and precision, got into separate pursuit boats, sleek craft with narrow prows and ice-cutting keels. The men strapped themselves in, sealed the clear protective canopy over them, and dropped the craft into the icy water. The pursuit boats bounced across the choppy water, striking chunks of ice but closing on the target. The main boat circled, approaching from the opposite direction. Each of the master harpooners crossed in front of the albino whale, popping the canopy enclosures and standing up in their compartments. With perfect balance, they hurled long stun staves into the whale, delivering a blast of numbing energy. The whale rolled and came toward the whaling boat. The master harpooners pursued, but by now the main boat was close enough, and four other harpooners leaned over the deck. Like a well-practiced Roman legion hurling javelins, they pitched stun staves with enough force to render the whale unconscious. The two pursuit craft approached the furred hulk, and, working as a team, the master harpooners delivered the coup de grace. Later, as the pursuit craft were winched up to the boat, furriers and skinners strapped on spiked footwear and rappelled down the vessel sides to the floating carcass. Abelard had seen whales taken many times before, but he had an aversion to the actual butchering process, so he crossed to the starboard deck and stared northward at the mountain ranges of icebergs. Their rugged shapes reminded him of the steep rocks that formed the fjord walls near where he lived. The whaling vessel had reached the far northern limit of even the native hunting waters. Chum whaling crews never ventured into these high latitudes, since their enormous vessels could not navigate the treacherous waters. Alone at the bow, Abelard enjoyed the prismatic purity of Arctic ice, a crystal glow that enhanced the shrouded sunlight. He heard the grind of colliding icebergs and stared, not realizing what his peripheral vision registered. Something gnawed at his subconscious until finally his gaze centered on one of the monoliths of ice, a squarish mountain that appeared fractionally grayer than the others. It reflected less light. He squinted, then retrieved a pair of binoculars left lying on the deck. Abelard listened to the wet sounds behind him.
the men shouting as they cut their prize into pieces ready to take home. He focused the oil lenses and stared at the floating iceberg. Glad to have a distraction from the bloody work, Abelard spent long minutes scrutinizing fragments that had been hacked out of the ice. The shards were too precise, too exact to have broken free from the glacial shelf and drifted about, battering and scraping other icebergs. Then, at water level, he saw something that looked suspiciously like a door. He marched up to the bridge deck. "You'll be at work here for another hour, won't you, Captain?" The big-shouldered man nodded. "Aye, then we go home tonight. Do you want to get down into the wet work?" Abelard drew himself up, queasy at the prospect of being smothered in whale blood. No, actually, I'd like to borrow one of the small boats to go explore something I found on an iceberg." Normally he would have asked for an escort, but the whalers were all occupied with the butchery. Even in these cold, uncharted seas, Abelard would be glad to be away from the smell of death. The captain raised his bushy eyebrows. Abelard could tell the gruff man wanted to express his skepticism, but he maintained his silence. His broad, flat face carried only respect for the planetary governor. Abelard Harkonnen knew how to handle a boat himself, often taking one into the fjords and exploring the coastline, so he declined the offer of other whalers to accompany him. Alone, he cruised away at a slow speed, watching out for dangerous ice. Behind him, the butchering continued, filling the iron-scented air with a richer smell of blood and entrails. Twice, as he piloted his boat through the maze of floating mountains, Abelard lost sight of his target, but eventually he found it again. Hidden among the drifting icebergs, this one chunk seemed not to have moved. He wondered if it was anchored in place. He brought the small boat up against the rugged side, then momentum locked it to the ice. A feeling of unreality and displacement shrouded this strange monolith. As he gingerly stepped out of the boat and onto the nearest flat white surface, he realized just how exotic this object was. The ice was not cold. Abelard bent to touch what appeared to be milky shards of ice. He rapped with his knuckles. The substance was some kind of polymer crystal, a translucent solid that had the appearance of ice. Almost. He stomped hard, and the iceberg echoed beneath him. Very odd indeed. He rounded a jagged corner to the place where he'd seen a geometrically even line of cracks, a parallelogram that might have been an access hatch. He stared at it until he found an indentation, an access panel that appeared to have been damaged, perhaps in a collision with a real iceberg. He found an activation button, and the trapezoidal covering slid aside. He gasped as a strong cinnamon scent wafted out, a pungent odor that he recognized instantly. He had smelled enough of it during his time on Arrakis. Melange. He breathed deeply, just to make sure, then ventured into the eerie corridors. The floors were smooth, as if worn down by many feet. A secret base? A command post? A hidden archive? He discovered room upon room filled with null entropy containers, sealed bins that bore the pale blue griffin of House Harkonnen. A stockpile of spice put here by his own family. And no one had told him of it. A grid map showed how far the storehouse extended beneath the water. Here on Lankavile, under Abelard's own nose, the Baron had secreted a huge illegal hoard. Such an amount of spice could have purchased this entire planetary system many times over. Abelard's mind reeled, unable to comprehend the treasure he had stumbled upon. He needed to think. He needed to talk to Emmy. With her quiet wisdom, she would give him the advice he needed. Together, they would decide what to do. Though he considered the whaling crew to be honest, wholesome men, such a stockpile would tempt even the best of them. Abelard left in a hurry, sealed the door behind him, and scrambled aboard his boat. Upon returning to the whaling ship, he made sure to mark the coordinates carefully in his mind. When the captain asked if he had found anything, Abelard shook his head and retreated into his private cabin. He didn't trust himself to control his expressions around the other men. It would be a long voyage home until he could get back to his wife. Oh, how he missed her! How he needed her wisdom! Before leaving the dock at Tula Fjord, the captain presented the fur whale's liver to Abelard as his reward, though it was worth little compared to the share of the albino's fur he had given to each of the crewmen. When he and Emmy dined together at the main lodge for the first time in a week, Abelard was distracted and fidgeting, waiting for the chef to finish her grand workings. The steaming, savory whale liver came out on two gilded silver platters, surrounded by mounds of salted string greens with a side dish of smoked oyster nuts. The long formal dining table could accommodate up to 30 guests, but Abelard and Emmy sat next to each other, near one end, serving themselves from the platters. Emmy had a pleasant, wide, Lankavile face, and a squarish chin that was not glamorous or beautiful. But Abelard adored it anyway. Her hair was the truest color of black and hung straight, cut horizontally just below her shoulders. Her round eyes were the rich brown of polished jasper. Often Abelard and his wife would eat with the others in the communal dining hall, joining in the conversations. But since Abelard had just returned from a long whaling journey, everyone in the household knew the two wanted to talk quietly. Abelard had no qualms about telling his wife the great secret he had discovered in the ICC. Emmy was silent, but deep. She thought before she spoke, and didn't talk unless she had something to say. Now she listened to her husband and did not interrupt him. When Abelard finished his tale, Emmy sat in silence, thinking about what he had said. He waited long enough for her to consider a few possibilities, then said to her, "What shall we do, Emmy?" "All that wealth must have been stolen from the Emperor's share. It's probably been there for years." She nodded to reinforce her own convictions. "You don't want to dirty your hands with it." "But my own half-brother has deceived me." "He must have plans for it. He didn't tell you because he knew you'd feel honor-bound to report it." Abelard chewed a mouthful of the tart string greens and swallowed, washing it down with a Caladan Blanc. With the smallest hints, Emmy could always tell exactly what he was thinking. "But I do feel honor-bound to report it." She considered for a moment, then said, "If you call attention to this stockpile, I can think of many ways it could harm us, harm the people of Lankavile, or harm your own family. I wish you had never found it." He looked into her jasper brown eyes to see if any glimmer of temptation had crossed them, but he saw only concern and caution there. "Perhaps Vladimir is avoiding taxes or just embezzling to fill the coffers of House Harkonnen," she ventured, her expression turning hard. "But he is still your brother. If you report him to the Emperor, you could bring disaster upon your house." Abelard realized another consequence and groaned. "If the Baron is imprisoned, then I would have to control all of the Harkonnen holdings. Assuming we keep the Arrakis fief, I'd have to go back there, or else live on Gedi Prime." Miserably, he took another drink of the wine. "I couldn't stomach either option, Emmy. I like it here." Emmy reached over to touch his hand. She stroked it, and he raised her hand to his lips, kissing her fingers. "Then we've come to our decision," she said. "We know the spice is there, but we'll just leave it be."
The desert is a surgeon cutting away the skin to expose what is underneath. Freeman saying. As the moon rose copper-red over the desert horizon, Leet Kynes and seven Freemen departed the rocks and made their way out to the soft, curving dunes, where they could be easily seen. One by one, the men made the sign of the fist, in accordance with Freeman tradition at the sign of first moon. "Prepare yourselves," Stilgar said moments later, his narrow face like a desert hawk's in the moonlight. His pupils had dilated, making his solid blue eyes look black. He wrapped his desert camouflage around him, as did the other, older gorillas. It is said that when one waits for vengeance, time passes slowly but sweetly. Leet Kynes nodded. He was dressed to look like a weak, water-fat village boy, but his eyes were as hard as Velen's steel. Beside him, his siege mate and blood brother Warwick, a slightly taller lad, nodded as well. This night the two would pretend to be helpless children caught out in the open, irresistible targets for the anticipated Harkonnen patrol. "We do what must be done still." Leet clapped a hand on Warwick's padded shoulder. These 12-year-olds had already blooded more than 100 Harkonnens apiece, and would have stopped keeping count except for their friendly rivalry with each other. "I trust my brother with my life." Warwick covered Leet's hand with his own. "Leet would be afraid to die without me at his side." "With or without you, Warwick, I don't plan to die this night," Leet said, which elicited a deep laugh from his companion. "I plan to exact revenge." After the orgy of poisoned death had fallen upon Belar camp, Freeman rage had spread from siege to siege like water soaking into sand. From the thopter markings found near the hidden cistern, they knew who was responsible. All Harkonnens must pay. Around Carthag and Arsunt, word was passed to timid-looking workers and dusty servants who had been placed inside Harkonnen strongholds. Some of the infiltrators scrubbed the floors of troop barracks using dry rags and abrasives. Others posed as water sellers supplying the occupation force. As the tale of the poisoned village passed from one Harkonnen soldier to another in progressively exaggerated anecdotes, the Freeman informants noted who derived the greatest pleasure from the news. They studied the crew assignments and route logs of Harkonnen patrols. Before long, they had learned exactly which Harkonnen troopers were responsible and where they could be found. With a high-pitched squeak and a dancing blur of gossamer wings, a tiny distrans bat swooped from observation outcroppings in the mountains behind them. When Stilgar held up a hand, the bat landed on his forearm, primly holding its wings and waiting for a reward. Stilgar drew a tiny drop of water from the sipping tube at his throat and let the moisture fall into the bat's open mouth. Then he brought forth a thin cylinder and placed it to his ear, listening as the bat emitted complex, wavering squeaks. Stilgar tapped the bat on its head, then flung it into the night air again, like a falconer releasing his bird. He turned back to his expectant troop, a predatory smile on his moon-shadowed face. "Their ornithopter has been seen over the ridge. The Harkonnens fly a predictable path as they scan the desert. But they have not been on patrol for so long they are complacent. They do not see their own patterns." "Tonight they fly into a web of death," Warwick said from the dune top, lifting his fist in a very unboylike gesture. The Freemen checked their weapons, loosed kris knives in sheaths at their sides, tested the strength of garrotting cords. With swishing robes, they erased all marks of their passage, leaving the two young men alone. Stilgar looked up at the night sky, and a muscle on his jaw flickered. "This I learned from Umma Kynes. When we were cataloging lichens, we saw a rock lizard that seemed to vanish before our eyes. Kynes said to me, 'I give you the chameleon.
whose ability to match itself with its background tells you all you need to know about the roots of ecology and the foundations of personal identity.
Stilgar looked gravely at his men, and his expression faltered.
I don't know exactly what he meant, but now we must all become chameleons of the desert.
Wearing light-colored clothes, Leet stepped up the slip face of the dune, leaving deliberate, painfully apparent footprints. Warwick followed, just as clumsily, while the other freemen spread out on the flat sand. After pulling out breathing tubes and covering their faces with loose hoods, they flailed their arms in a blur of motion. Powdery sand engulfed them, and then they lay still. Leet and Warwick ran about, smoothing wrinkles on the surface and leaving nothing but their own footprints. They finished just as the patrol thopter whirred over the line of rocks, flashing red lights. The two white-clad freemen froze out in the open, their bright clothes unmistakable against the pale, moonlit sand. No true freeman would ever be caught in such a show of clumsiness. But the Harkonnens didn't know that. They would not suspect. As soon as the thopter came into view, Leet made an exaggerated gesture of alarm.
Come on, Warwick. Let's make a good show of it.
The two ran away pell-mell as if in a panic. Predictably, the thopter circled to intercept them. A powerful spotlight flooded down. Then a laughing side-gunner leaned out of the thopter. He fired his laser gun twice, sketching a line of melted glass upon the sand surface. Leet and Warwick tumbled down the steep side of a dune. The gunner fired three more blasts, missing them each time. The thopter landed on the broad surface of a nearby dune, close to where Stilgar and his men had buried themselves. Leet and Warwick flashed each other a smile and prepared for the second part of the game. Sidegunner Keel shouldered his still-hot laser gun rifle and popped open the door.
Let's go hunt some freemen.
He jumped onto the sand as soon as Garan had landed the patrol craft. Behind them, the fresh-faced recruit Jostin fumbled for his own weapon.
It would be easier just to shoot them from above.
What kind of sport would that be? Garan asked in his gruff voice.